Good morning. So, last time we finished by covering how what you would think happens in multi-threaded code with respect to how memory is updated, when things are stored, when things are loaded, doesn't actually end up happening. And we learned that in addition to processors deciding that, oh, you're loading something, I'm not going to really care whether I do that load before or after some store, unless you tell me to care, compilers act the same way. Compilers reorder loads and stores to do optimizations, and they generally optimize your code, assuming, hey, there's no other threads. If you're storing one and then storing two, I can just store two, I can get rid of the storing one, no one's going to see that. Even if you're thinking, oh, there's another thread that's going to read one from this at some point. And that you have to do something special, and we saw some options you could do, and learned that pthreads does all this for you. It has the special constructs to say, hey, processor, hey, compiler, don't mess this up. There's another thread doing stuff here. Make sure that's going to work. We talked about cache coherency, which is that, well, processors each have a cache, and we don't want to actually access a shared memory all the time. We want to usually access the cache, including even for most writes. If we're like updating a counter on our stack, we don't want to have to talk to all to memory to do that. We want to do it in our cache. And we had this idea that the processors would have a state for each cache block, and they communicate via a shared bus to make sure that at most one processor was writing each cache block at a time, had it in that modified state, and otherwise they were allowed to have multiple copies of a value across the processors. Based on that, we discovered our good hardware support for locking, building blocks with just loads and stores when they occurred in the order we actually expected, was possible, but really annoying. And happily, because hardware has this way of making sure each processor only writes a cache block or piece of memory one at a time, it can implement this read, modify, write operation. That we can ensure that, that while we're updating a value with some operation like exchange it with another value, so read a value and write a value with one instruction. That was one example in x86, atomic exchange. While that's happening, nothing else is sneaking in and writing a different value. And so we know that, like, we read the value that was there just before we wrote, for example. And finally, we looked at, well, all the constructs we had for building things like locks, including with these atomic read, modify, write operations, had this sort of try and keep trying until you can go strategy. Even with our load and stores, we had this loop where we were waiting for when, check if there's a note from Bob, check if there's a note from Bob, check if there's a note from Bob, until it wasn't there. And that's really annoying because, well, we'd like something else to use the processor. We don't want to be wasting an entire core just because we're waiting for something. We want to run something else. We want some way of giving up the CPU, but getting it back when we're ready. And we saw this strategy that we'd have a lock where we had a wait queue, a queue of threads, and we'd have the unlock operation tell the scheduler, hey, this thread was waiting, please make it runnable now. And we keep this still in sync with multiple cores by having the lock and unlock operations use that slow spinning lock, but only for the lock and unlock, so it would be very short, so we wouldn't be so concerned that we'd be leaving a waiting thread spinning all the time for the CPU. So any questions about what we covered last time, before I move on? Okay, So I'd like to go even further back to the post quiz from last week, because I was surprised how many people got this question wrong. Not, this is not the question, but this is the code that was in the question. And the question was asking, you know, we had several possibilities for, you know, when we, if we could call this from multiple threads, you're likely to find out, my linked list doesn't contain all the things I expected it to. Something's missing here. The question is, why would that happen? What's the most likely reason? And the way I wanted you to reason about this is to say, where are these variables stored? That if we're thinking about how this gets executed, we have a stack for thread one stack and a thread two stack, and we have a heap, and we have globals. So head here, I guess I'll try to do this with so head here is in the global space, and our new head here is on the stack of one of the threads. Each thread has their own copy of new head because it's a local variable, and it's going to be stored on their stack or in registers. And it, each one of these points to, and we'll go back. Yes, yeah. Each one of these points to a heap allocation. So there's some space on the heap, there's some space on the heap, and because there are two calls to new, there's two spaces on the heap. So they're completely unshared, and no thread knows how to get to the others because they have to like figure out what the point is. So the next variable here and the value variable are unique for each thread. And then we have this assignment, which is taking our pointer value, taking where thread one takes this value and moves it into here. And so it makes it point to its copy on the heap. And the problem was that thread one can do that, and then thread two can do that. But the problem was with this operation here, that we have a pointer to head in here, which pointed to wherever this pointed to before, and that can be happened in the wrong order. But note that this assignment here is a pointer assignment. Doesn't do any dereferencing, so it's never the case that either thread touches the linked list node the other allocates. And the sort of race we were worried about was something like this would happen. That both threads would read the same value of head when they were setting the next pointer on their independent copy of the node, and then they both assign their node to the head, and we'd end up forgetting about the node, in this case, of the thread on the right. So any questions about this? Okay, so what's the solution to prevent this from happening? If I tell you, here's a function, I want it to work properly when I'm going to call it from a lot of threads, what would you do? Yeah. Yeah, so we want to, the fix would be pthread mutex lock, and we'd have some like head lock, and we have an unlock. At the end, and we have a lock that we declared and somehow called pthread mutex signed it on. And that would make sure that the threads would have to take turns, so this ordering would not be possible. And also would do handy things that are much more subtle, like make sure that the write to value of the new node happens before, is visible in time for us to out of update head itself. So you can't read, not have value be written in the meantime. Yes.
So does the mutex block just make sure that the value that is accessed on key doesn't be changed?
So the question is, the mutex lock makes sure two threads don't run the part between while the mutex is locked at the same time. So in this case, it would just say, this function we're going to run one at a time, is what we'd be saying by having a mutex lock around it. It also, if you remember when we talked about memory ordering, make sure that all our stores are visible by the time when we unlock. So we don't have to worry about anything like the compiler forgetting, deciding, oh, I'm going to write new head value after you update head, which is actually a legal thing for the compiler to do when optimizing this code. And it's also a legal thing for the processor to do when executing if we don't have a special instruction. And that would be really weird if you're reading the list. Yes?
So do locks prevent reordering? Or?
Question is, do locks prevent reordering? Yes. All the pthread functions do what you would hope they would do with respect to preventing reordering. So it's all part of that, and good lock implementation. So XV6's locks acquire and release prevents reordering because they know that it would be really hard to use the lock if it didn't. Like, it's not enough to not have things run at a time. You actually want all the stores and loads to finish before and after the lock. Yeah, so locks prevent the compiler from deciding, oh, I'm going to write new head value too late, and they prevent the compiler from, and they prevent, well, the two threads from running at once to update the list. So, any other questions about this? Okay. And add a lock is the basic pattern. When you're worried about, you know, some threads could get interleaved in some way, that's how you avoid it, which is usually easier than figuring out, like, what's the scenario where it breaks like this. Though, in the question, the hope was you figure that out by realizing all the other possibilities were things that weren't shared between the threads, which is definitely something you shouldn't. What part is local to a thread, what's actually visible to multiple threads. Okay, so when we finished up last time, we started talking about barriers. And we were motivated by this idea that we have parallel computation, meaning we're doing one big task, one big computation, and we want to use multiple threads for it, presumably because we have multiple cores, and we want it to go faster by using all the cores to get more computation done in the same amount of time. So for example, if I want to compute the minimum of 100 million elements, I do the minimum of 50 million on each CPU, so with one thread per CPU, and I wait for all that all to finish, then I read the two minimums and take the minimum of those. And barriers are a convenient way of doing this wait for everything to finish operation. But they're specifically designed for things like this where you do a part of the computation on every CPU, then you need to get all the results together for some reason. And the barrier does this get all the results together operation rather than like having a loop where you join threads or something else. And we'll learn about some of the something else's probably later today. And the API for a barrier is that it has some sort of initialized operation where you say, how many threads are we going to use? And there's a wait operation which waits until all the other threads have followed wait. So after number of threads, call wait, all threads that have called wait keep going. But before that, they're stopped. So the pattern with our parallel min is that we compute the min of $50 million elements in one thread and in the other, and it's okay that they aren't quite in sync. You know, something happened, something was scheduled, and the CPU thread one's on, so it ran a little late. That's fine. The barrier's going to fix that for us, and it's going to make them not keep going until after both have done. So in this case, thread 0 is going to be held until thread 1 finishes. And when thread 1 calls wait, we're going to say, oh, everyone's called wait, you can just keep going. We're done. Okay, so any questions on what's happening here? And we can choose, in this case, I just arbitrarily chose, I'm going to compute the final sum in thread 0. I could have chosen thread 1 for that, doesn't matter. Any other question?
So would it be possible for you to have, say, two sets of two threads, so like you've got four threads total, and you want to keep, say, these two in sync and these two in sync, how would you sort of know which two were the ones that called barrier.wait?
So the question is, let's say I had more threads.
Yeah.
So this barrier is an object, so I could have barrier, so I could have like, I'll show you the real syntax later. I could have like barrier one, barrier two, and different thread, one thread could do barrier one dot, and we could do barrier one initialize, barrier two initialize, and just treat them as separate objects, and call wait separately on them, and they'd act independently. So for the scenario where you want to have two different pairs of threads that work together, but they don't all work together, we'd have multiple barriers. If we wanted them all to work together, we could have a barrier where we initialize it with four. So this is, the dot is meant to mean that this is an object. Like, so we can have multiple of these like a lock. We can have multiple locks. Your question? Okay. So the other thing about barriers, so this is that they're reusable. And the classic case where this comes up is where we're like doing some sort of simulation where we have time steps. So here I have an array of arrays, which is result, time, location. So I compute the result at time 0, and then I use all the results to compute the result at time 1. And that means I need to wait for the other threads to have computed their results, because I'm using them as part of my computation. I'm reading what the other thread just did, so I need to wait for the thread to finish computing it before I can go on. And this is a very common pattern when people are doing simulations for scientific purposes, because you commonly say your time is like physical time for some physical system, like, say, the weather, and your location is like some part of the world. And like, you guess your weather in the next 5 minutes in your simulation based on weather in the previous 5 minutes, and all the weather around it. Like, that's a common simulation pattern, and this is, barriers are really nice for implementing that, because they're reusable like this, so we call barrier.wait, and after we've waited for all the other threads, we can reuse the barrier again without any other setup. It just keeps working, so we just have this loop where we call barrier.wait, and every thread waits for every other before they go on to the next iteration. And so we can have these dependencies, which we know are okay because the wait makes sure that we aren't reading this until result 0 is computed and stored properly. And we get the same result, same guarantees sort of in the next time step. And we can have these dependencies. And this is the most common use of barriers, is simulations like this, where you divide up some grid and you step forward in time, advancing the simulation. and you don't have to worry that you're using things computed by other threads all the time. The barriers make that okay, and are probably the simplest way of making that okay. They're simplest synchronization construct. They're a lot simpler way of doing this than anything else we'll talk about, because that's basically all they're designed to do. So, any questions about barriers? Yeah. So what if you initialize the barrier, you don't know how many threads you want? Well, then you can't use it. Because wait's gonna figure out how to proceed based on how many calls to wait there have been. It's not gonna look at how many threads are in your system, because as mentioned, you could not be using the barrier for all your threads. Okay. So pthreads has barriers. In the API, so there's pthread barrier T is the barrier type, so you can define as many as you like. There's a barrier init function, takes a pointer to the barrier you want to initialize, and the number of threads. It also takes an attributes argument, which you can look up what's in there. There's not much that's useful. And then there's a barrier wait function. Yeah? So the question is, what happens when a thread's waiting on a barrier? So, here, what's happening to thread 0 during this point in time? So like with mutexes, when a thread's waiting on the barrier, it's going to be not scheduled. We're going to give up the CPU and let other things run.
Is thread 1 then prioritized?
So the question is, thread 1 prioritized? So this is not part of what a barrier does. You could imagine that might be a good way to design a scheduler. That's a reasonable choice, but I would be surprised if a system did it, just usually because they don't tie the implementation of barriers to the scheduler that tightly. But even though it would make sense to do. But at least thread 0, and if there were more waiting threads, have all given up their CPU, so if thread 1 wasn't already running, we'd certainly have a place to run it now. Because it's waiting. Okay. So other questions about barriers? Okay, so our upcoming homework, our main threading homework, is going to deal with a simulation which is called Conway's Game of Life. And Conway's Game of Life has a grid of values, x and y coordinates, and we basically, at every step, we compute the new grid values from the old grid values around there. So this is a very natural fit to the barrier pattern if you want to try to speed this up by using multiple threads. That you just divide up the grid some way, have some thread handle one part of it, some thread handle another part of it, and use a barrier to make sure that before you move on to the next time, that you know that this from grid value is going to be safe to read, that it's not going to be still being updated. So, any questions about this sort of pseudocode? That's the life homework. One note I have about the life homework is we provide you, in the homework, naive code that looks like this, because this is probably the most straightforward single-threaded implementation. We have two, and we swap. The swap operation is not like a deep copy, it just moves pointers around, so it's really fast. When you're implementing it, you're probably going to want to do something where you don't actually use a swap, because if you use a swap with barriers, you need to wait and then wait, right? Because you can't access, you have to make sure from to grid has been completely changed before you swap, and you have to make sure from grid's not being read until after you swapped. And you can avoid that by just switching between two grids in separately in each thread. And this is a common thing you'll see happen in parallel code is that you don't want to do some operation like swap, which requires everyone to wait for you to do this operation both before and after, when you have this alternative, like just saying, are we on an even or odd time? And choose the appropriate grid to use, rather than swapping it, even if the swap is just moving some pointers around. Okay. So any questions about this pattern? Okay. And the first part of the life homework is just doing implementing with barriers. That's for the checkpoint. The second part is implementing your own barriers. And one way you have to test them is using them with this. And you might say, you know, what are we going to implement them with? So we saw barriers. They're very useful, and they do things that you definitely can't do with locks. Like, there's not really a way of doing this wait operation, especially with more than two threads, with locks. But you can't actually do what locks do with barriers. Because you don't like know, because like thread zero might acquire the lock like 50 times. Barriers don't really have a way of representing that. Thread zero acquires the lock 50 times, thread one acquires it only once. It's something you might do with locks, can't do that with barriers. But we'll have two constructs we'll talk about, semaphores and condition variables, which are more general. They are general enough that they can implement locks and barriers and lots of other useful things about how you want to coordinate threads. Different other patterns like barriers that will come up in real programs where you'll want threads to work together in this way. Semaphores and condition variables will let you implement all of them with one construct. Obviously, they're more complicated than barriers or locks because they do more. And I'm gonna start with semaphores. And we can think of semaphores as exactly a generalization of a lock, because we'll have the simple case where a semaphore just looks like a lock. So semaphore has a non-negative integer value and two operations. So it has an operation which is called either P or down or wait, which waits for the semaphore to be positive and then decrements it by one. It has an operation called V, or up, or signal, or post, which increments the semaphore by one, and this will wake up a thread that was waiting on a down operation if needed. So something to note is that if you only consider value equals zero as locked, and value equals one as unlocked, if those are the only values you care about, this operation sort of looks like a lock, and this operation sort of looks like an unlock. So in that sense, they're a generalization of a lock, but they're more flexible than a lock. I know there are lots of names. I will try to mostly use down or up or wait or post, but you will see all these names in the literature. I know P and V are really horrible names for us. They come from the Dutch, because this was originally published by Dijkstra's group, and Dijkstra is Dutch. That's where those names come from. Okay, this is the basic operations, and we'll see several ways of using it. So it has an integer there, value, but a rule is that we're never going to read or write the value directly. The only way we're going to access the value is with these down and up operations. We're never going to ask what the value is. We're never going to explicitly set the value, except when we're initializing a semaphore, we'll set what the initial value is. And note that it never becomes negative. We don't wrap around. Instead, we wait. And that's just always the rule. If you would want to make it negative, instead you wait until you don't have to. And And sort of the most natural use case of semaphores is you can think of the value as being a count of some resource. And the idea is that never becomes negative because you're giving away that resource. The down operation is saying, I want to reserve a copy of that resource. I'm taking it. And the upper operation is I'm returning it. And of course, you can't take something that's not there, which is why you have to wait for it to be positive. And when you return something, someone who's trying to take something might get to go. So one way of thinking of this is like tracking library books. You know, if library has three copies of a book, our reserve is the down operation, our return is the up operation. And the semaphore is the value is the number of free copies of that book in the library. So we conceptually have these three copies, you know, and if we want to take one, we call down to reserve a copy that decrements our value, and you know, presumably we mark the copy as taken out. And we can keep doing that until we take out all the copies and the semaphore is at zero. There are no free copies. They're all taken out. And at this point, we can reserve a new book. So we can call down again. And I used the wrong color, which I just noticed now. We can call down again to try reserving a book, but we'll wait. We're going to wait because the count is zero. We can't take one yet. We're going to keep looking, the count's zero, all the copies are taken out. And eventually someone's going to return a book, and that's going to, by calling up, and that's going to release this waiter, so they're going to return copy three, and we're going to stop waiting on down, so the semaphore's value is going to stay at zero, but we're going to, you know, the spurred people who were trying to reserve a book are going to get their copy, and the value's going to stay at zero. This makes sense. Yeah.
Does it care if the value exceeds the initial value? Like if you copy it off?
Does it care if the value?
If say you start with three.
Yeah.
Then would it limit the value to be max three?
Oh, so the question is, can I call up even if it's bigger than the initial value? Absolutely. So there's no other restrictions on what semaphores do. As far as what the value can be, besides that it can't be negative. We aren't constrained to the initial value. Obviously, in a real implementation, it's going to be like a 32-bit integer or something like that. But other than that, there's no other constraints. So semaphores can implement a lot of useful patterns. And you can see here, they're already, you know, this basic idea that tracking the number of resources that are free, this is already more than you can easily do with locks. Because this is, you know, kind of like a lock, but a little better. So one thing is you can implement a mutex with a semaphore. You have a semaphore within a value of 1. And the value 1 is the mutex is free, the value 0 is it's busy, the lock is you decrement the value, and if it's already 0, you're going to wait until it becomes would become 1, and unlock is you increment the value. And this is exactly a mutex, and because semaphores have the thread wait and generally usually not busy wait, you know, this will do exactly what we want typically. Just like a mutex. Okay. So we can also do some things we didn't know how to do. So one example is pthread join. Pthread join waits for a thread to finish. And the semaphore is a way you could implement that. So you have your thread xset function that you arrange to be called when a thread returns or explicitly xsets. And you have your join function. And you start the semaphore at 0, saying, you know, and 0 is going to indicate either the thread isn't finished or it was already joined. So that's what the value 0 indicates. And the value 1 is going to indicate the thread is finished and it's not joined. So by asking for down, we're going to either wait for the thread to finish, if it hasn't already, or if the thread's already finished, it's going to have a value of 1, and down's going to complete immediately. So that does exactly what we want join to do. And our xset is just going to increment it, so because we haven't finished, so we're going to say make it so we have finished, and if the value becomes 1, that means no one's tried to join it, and if the value stays at 0, that means someone tried to join it, so this does exactly what we want by waking them up. So questions on this example? So notice that semaphores have this nice property that because they remember this value, we can sort of wake up someone later. And that's, you know, what they're designed for, one of the things they're designed for. Other, okay. So POSIX has semaphores. This is what their API looks like, and that's why I showed you some of the other names. POSIX uses the names wait and post. Wait for down, post for up. And its semi-init function takes in the initial value you want, and it also takes in whether the semaphore is shared between processes. You'll probably pass 0 because we don't know how to have this variable shared between processes, but there is a way of doing that. So you've seen here that semaphores can do a bunch of things that locks couldn't do, but it's not immediately intuitive. Like if I have some synchronization problem, how do I solve it using semaphores? For example, most likely you did not immediately arise at this is how I implement pthread join idea. Like that's probably not obvious from the description of semaphores. So the general rule I like to use when thinking about how do I solve a problem with semaphores is think of what do I need to wait for? You know, like do I need to wait for a critical section to be finished? I need to wait for a queue to be non-empty, let's say, for an array to have space. And based on whatever I need to wait for, I think of something I can count where the count's going to be 0 while I need to wait. So for a critical section, it's the number of threads that can start a critical section now. And we saw that mutex implementation, unlocked was 1, because that meant one thread can start the critical section now. And when it was locked, it was 0. 0 threads can start the critical section now. And when we unlock, we say another thread can start the critical section. For our join example, the count is the number of threads that can join without waiting. So it starts at 0, we can't join immediately because the thread's not done. When the thread finishes, one thread can join it, so we increment the count. For items in a queue, if you want to wait for a queue to be non-empty, our count could be the number of items in the queue. When the queue is size 0, the queue is empty, we have to wait. When it's bigger, we don't. And assuming we're consuming an item in a queue, the down operation does what we want. We'll see an example of that in a bit. For an array to have space, the count we're thinking of is probably the number of spaces for new items. And so when that's 0, we need to wait, there's not space. When it's not 0, we don't need to wait. And based on this count, you just do the up and down operations whenever you would do something that changes the count. And you know that, you know, you're gonna try to do the down operation, say, to start the critical section, and that's gonna wait when you're not allowed to yet, because you have to wait for someone to do, you know, to give you the resources to take. And so this is all like trying to make things look like that book borrowing situation where you want to reserve an item in a queue or an empty space, or want to reserve being the thread that joins the other thread, and we need to wait for it to be returned to the library, the ability to join a thread or an item in the queue to be returned or an empty space to be returned. You know, kind of like that example. We're making everything look like that by keeping track of this count where 0 means we're waiting non-zero means we aren't. And just using the down and up operations to change the count to match reality, or what we're planning on doing. And I guess something I didn't write here, which is probably useful to think about, is down is before and up is after, generally. We'll use the down before get resource, and up is after is release some resource, where the resource is the thing we're counting. Because we don't want to say, it's okay for you to take a space in the to read an item from the queue until after I put the item in the queue. We don't want to say, I want to wait for an item to be in the queue until, you know, I don't want to do that before, after I've already read an item from the queue. Okay, so questions on this intuition? Okay, so let's look at one of the most common patterns in multi-threaded code, which is the producer-consumer pattern. That we have a producer, or possibly multiple producers, and a buffer, and a consumer, or possibly multiple consumers. And the idea is that the producer computes something and sends it for the consumers to do something with. And if there can be multiple producers working in parallel, if we want to use all our cores, and multiple consumers working in parallel. And we have the shared buffer, and the buffer has a limited size because we don't want to run out of memory, at least. And we want to make sure that these producers and consumers work correctly, even though they're not working in lockstep. The producer might take variable amounts of time to compute each item, and if it gets too far ahead of the consumers, we want it to stop. If the consumers, get too far ahead of the producers, we want them to stop and wait for more items to be produced. We don't want them to try to read from an empty buffer and not like get a null pointer error. So you want to have them wait to catch up. And this comes up in all sorts of applications. So one concrete example is the C compiler often looks like this, where we have a preprocessor that goes to the compiler, that goes to the assembler, that goes to the linker, and kind of these can kind of work in parallel. And you could, you take advantage by having the preprocessor send what it did to the compiler and so on. And if you have multiple files, you might have multiple assemblers running, which all feed to the same linker, for example. So any questions on this scenario? We'll be using it a lot. Okay, so let's think about how do we do this with semaphores. And remember I said the intuition we wanted to use is what do we need to wait for? So the consumer needs to wait for the producers if the buffer is empty. And the producer needs to wait for consumers if the buffer is full. And any thread needs to wait while it's manipulating the buffer. We need to make sure that whatever array or linked list that's emulating the buffer, we don't have conflicts, two people trying to write to the same element in the buffer or update the same next pointer. So we're going to make a semaphore for each constraint. We're going to make a semaphore for the consumer to wait, which is going to have count the number of full slots. So number of items in buffer, equals 0 implies wait. So we're going to count the number of items in the buffer. Here we want to say number of spaces free in buffer equals 0 implies wait. So you want to count the number of free spaces. And that's what that semaphore is going to count. And we have our mutex, which is going to count, which is going to be 1 or 0. one is unlocked, zero is locked. So any questions on these choices as semaphores? So given that, we have our implementation. We have our full slots. There's initially nothing in the buffer, so it starts at zero. We have our empty slots. Initially, the buffer's empty, so we have the size of the buffer. We have our mutex, which initially is someone can grab it, so there's a number of threads that can grab it. And then we have our produce and consume functions, which could be called from multiple threads at the same time, which will do the right things. So our produce function, first we wait for an empty slot. And this wait is, remember, this is the down, so this reserves it. Then we lock the buffer to actually manipulate that safely. And then we unlock it, and then we say, oh, there's now a full slot that's ready to read. And in the consume, we do the opposite. We wait until there's a full slot, reserving it. Then we lock the buffer. And then we say, oh, now there's a free slot that you could reuse. So any questions on this code? So here, I wait for an empty slot, then lock the buffer. Can I do it the other way around? Can I lock the buffer, then reserve my empty slot? So some people shaking their head, no.
If you lock the buffer and then there's no empty slots, then
yeah, so the problem is if we do this, then we have this locked, then here we want consume. It just said, okay, I got my full slot, great. Now we're gonna wait for the buffer and we're never gonna get it. Because in order to get it, we need to first release the slot we just reserved. And this is known as a deadlock. And I'm showing you the example where I'm just saying there's one produce and one consume. You could also have this where like there are 100 consumes all stuck in the same way. And we'll talk more about deadlocks later because they are an important topic. But the order is important here. We want to wait before we actually tie up the buffer. And we need to do that because the way we stop waiting is someone uses the buffer. We can't tie up the buffer to prevent that. And I have that you can reorder the posts, and that's because post never waits, post being up. So up never waits, so the order doesn't actually matter. Because we'll always do both of them, we'll never do one and not the other because of waiting. So that was our implementation of the producer-consumer pattern with a fixed size buffer. This is, as I said, a very common pattern that you would want to implement talk between threads. Lots of use cases. So we have this empty and full slot counts, and that's how we kept in track. We just had one semaphore track the number of empty slots, one track the number of full. We reserve an empty or full slot depending on whether we're producer or consumer. And when we're done with it, we say, now there's a full slot from the producer, or now there's an empty slot from the consumer. And note that this code, like you've probably been thinking out, with one producer, one consumer, it still works if you have like 100 producers and one consumer or any combination, which is great. Okay, so that's like a nice good case for semaphores. I'd like to talk about one special case of semaphores just because you might see it. And this is binary semaphores, For some people, they like talking about simpler semaphores, semaphores where they work with like the semaphores we saw, but the count's only allowed to be 0 or 1. That you're not allowed to call up if it would increment the count above 1. And notably, these are exactly as powerful as regular semaphores. You can do all the things you can do with counting regular semaphores that count as high as you like with these semaphores. You might need more, but you can still do it. And the intuition is that we're going to just that you can use a binary semaphore to just handle the wake up operation and have a separate count that you store outside a semaphore, and you can implement a normal counting semaphore with binary semaphores. And what that looks like is something like this, that we have a second semaphore to protect the count because we need to keep it from being modified at the same time, but then we can actually implement our full counting semaphores using this. Using the observation that only when the count goes to 0 do we actually need to wait, and only when the count becomes 1 does someone actually, some thread actually need to be woken up. So you can just make that work with the binary semaphore. So they're equivalent. I taught you about counting semaphores because I think they're more useful to think about. Some people might want to teach you about binary semaphores first instead, but they can do all the same stuff. Yeah. Because I am bad at making slides. Yes. I'm glad people actually caught it, unlike my error last week where I set sum to I, or result to I on a sum example. Okay. So that's binary semaphores. So those are. So, any questions on this? Are people? Yeah.
So, if the count's 0, we call down with no wait.
Yeah.
What happens if we call down again? Is it like we know that it's next in line?
What happens if we call down again?
Yeah.
I probably forgot a mutex. Oh, sorry, I forgot some stuff here. That's important, actually. Down. Mutex.up. We need to release the mutex, so that's important. The idea is that when there's multiple people waiting on down, that's fine. The count's not allowed to go negative, but there's going to be a queue of waiters in the implementation of the semaphore. So even a binary semaphore can have, you could have called down 1,000 times in a binary semaphore, and now you have 1,000 threads waiting on that semaphore. And okay, I'm sorry for not checking this implementation, because releasing the mutex is very, very important, or else you have a deadlock again.
So on that queue of the waiters, though, do they know their order? Is it an actual queue?
So the question, is it an actual queue? We haven't specified. And I do not actually know if that, I don't know what the case is in POSIX, whether it's guaranteed that the first one is the one that wakes up first or is just arbitrary. Like, it would probably be better if it was an actual queue that worked in order, but I wouldn't guarantee it. Also, if you like have thread priorities, like you're doing priority scheduling, you might want to choose the highest priority one regardless of what the order in the queue was. Okay, so that's semaphores. And our textbook, our recommended textbook, doesn't like semaphores. Our view is that programming with blocks and condition variables is superior to programming with semaphores. They just don't want you to use them. In contrast, in prior versions of this, offerings of this class, Grimshaw has generally kind of glossed over locks and condition variables and mainly taught semaphores. So, different opinion. Well, our textbook's complaints are two things. So one is that semaphores are one construct that handles both waiting and making sure you have mutual exclusion. And our textbook authors think it's clearer if we separate those two tasks, separate the waiting task from the one at a time part. And this is what locks and condition variables do, that we'll have a separate way of saying, I want to wait for something to happen versus I want to just do this one at a time. Another thing they complain about is that when you're using semaphores, you need to be really careful to verify that you're calling up for every down, or else, you know, things get out of whack. Locks and condition variables, in some sense, let you be sloppier. And we'll see some examples of that later. So let's start talking about condition variables. So there's something called a monitor. And a monitor is something where you have a lock for mutual exclusion. And I said condition variables, which are a construct for waiting on an event. So waiting for something to happen. And we have some related data structure, which we only access with a lock, and that our condition variables are things we wait for that are based on that data structure. Like if we have a queue, that would be our data structure. The lock would be keeping us from accessing the queue for multiple threads at once. And the condition variables would be like, wait for the queue to be empty or full, that sort of thing. And a monitor is when you take a lock, some condition variables, and shared data. And in some languages, especially object-oriented languages, the monitor might literally be represented as an object. So for example, in Java, every object is a monitor. In addition to having all your instance variables, every single object in Java has a lock and a condition variable built in that you could use. And so it's all together, and we can say that's a monitor. Pthreads doesn't quite work that way. Pthreads is build your own. They provide locks, they provide condition variables. You're going to construct this combination of all of them that's a monitor yourself. So here's our idea of a monitor, is that we have basically an object which has a lock, some shared data, and some condition variables, and some operations that act on this shared data, you know, presumably use the lock. So we're going to acquire the lock before we access any of the monitor stuff. That's going to be one of our rules. That everything we do with all this stuff, first we acquire the lock before we touch it, we release the lock after we touch it. So one at a time, actually accessing the shared data. And the lock, of course, has a queue of threads that are waiting, possibly in some order. I'm just drawing it in order for now. Also, each of the condition variables have a queue of threads which are waiting for some condition to become true. It's going to be a different condition for each of the condition variables. And the condition variables are going to have some operations that we're going to use to manage how these threads wait. So there's going to be three operations, first two of which are most important. The last one is kind of an optimization. So the main operation is wait, that I know that I can't do what I want yet. Like, for example, I want to consume an item from a buffer, but the buffer is empty. So I'm going to wait. And when we wait, we pass our condition variable and the lock, and the wait operation unlocks the lock and adds the thread to the queue and reacquires the lock before it returns. So the idea is when you call wait, the calling thread gets added to one of those condition variable queues until it gets removed. And because it unlocks the lock, it allows a thread from the locks queue to go. Which is good, because hopefully that thread is going to do what we want to do, what we're waiting for, like put an item in the queue. Maybe not, but hopefully, so we definitely want it to go. So then we have operations on condition variables. So we have an operation called broadcast. And broadcast just says, okay, I'm going to take a condition variable, and I'm going to take all the threads that are waiting on it right now, and I'm going to remove them from that queue and have them start waiting for the lock. So you just move them from the condition variable queue to the lock queue, so later on they'll end up getting to run. And acquire the lock, access the shared data, see that, oh, yep, there's space, there's stuff on the queue now for me to read. Great. There's also a signal operation, which is like broadcast, but instead of taking all the threads on the queue, it just chooses one. In the condition variables we'll be using, it chooses one arbitrarily. You might want it to choose like the first one. Not guaranteed, but it chooses one, and that starts waiting for the lock, and then gets to a chance eventually to actually access the data. So let's look at how condition variables work with implementing our pthread join again, or wait for something to finish idea. So here's that pattern. So our wait operation, our, you know, this is basically join, and our, you know, exit. So we're going to have some shared data. In this case, our shared data is the are we finished. That's our protected data. So we're going to acquire the lock, we're going to look at that, say our, look at the finished value, and if it's not set, we want to wait for it to become true. So we call wait. So after, you know, and we acquire the lock to do this, this is how we ensure that, you know, we don't check it and then it changes and then we start waiting. But because we have the lock, we know that that can't happen. That once we started waiting, we know it was definitely false before we started waiting. We also have a way of, you know, we check whether we need to wait at all. Because one case is finish is called first, then wait for finish is called. We need that to work correctly. The way that happens is that we don't even wait in that case. And you might say, why is there a loop here? We don't need a loop. Turns out we do. I'll explain later. But indeed, from what I've described so far, it seems like that should just be an if statement. Why do you have a loop? So we wait until it finished. And note that pthreadconwait handles making sure that a thread can't sneak in between the time we start waiting and release the lock. And that's why it's one operation together, because it makes sure that that doesn't go wrong. In our finish operation, we call broadcast. So this means that if anyone was waiting, anyone started waiting after checking its spouse, they'll be woken up. And that guarantees it. And the way conwait works is it guarantees that you start waiting before you release the lock, so we're okay. So our typical pattern, you know, is wait for finish, acquires the lock. Maybe our finish thread starts at the exact same time. That's okay. And it starts waiting. We check the finished variable. We find out it's not true. We start waiting on the condition variable. And this simultaneously releases the lock and adds ourselves to the wait queue for the condition variable. So that means that even though the finished thread gets to run right away, when it broadcasts, it's going to wake us up from our wait on the condition variable. We're going to get to run. We'll wait for the lock because the finished thread broadcasted while the lock was held. And when we're done waiting for the lock, we're going to see that finished is now true. We can exit the loop, and we're done. So this makes sense. And of course, there's the simpler timeline where we just call finished runs first, then wait for finished runs, and it doesn't even have to wait. Okay. So any questions on the example in general? Yeah?
Could you explain again why you only need broadcast and not signal? Like why you move everything in the queue at once?
So we don't know yet why you would only need broadcast, not say no. I'll explain in a bit. And it has to do with why the loop is there. But yeah, so right now it seems like they do very different things, and there's some things you could do with signal that you can't do with broadcast. So why do we have this loop around pre-Fredholm weights? You know, we only broadcast if finish is true. So if we wake up from a wait, it should be the case that finish is always true. We just need an if statement. And that's a very logical conclusion because I didn't tell you all about what wait does. I told you wait releases the lock and adds herself to the queue, you know, atomically. That's fine. But it does something else. You know, there's something else about it. If you look at the manual page, it says spurious wake-ups may occur. What is a spurious wake-up? That means wait can return even though nothing happened. Sometimes you'll get unlucky and wait will just decide, well, no one called broadcast or signal, but I'm waking you up anyways. That seems really annoying. Why would pthreads do this? And the main answer is it makes implementing condition variables simpler. That there's some like corner cases with multiple cores where you can make a simpler and faster implementation of condition variables by allowing spurious wakeups to occur very occasionally. And that's why they chose to do this. So they chose to make it so you have to write a while loop all the time just so they could make the condition variables slightly faster and easier to implement. It also does happen that in real code that uses condition variables, it's often hard to avoid the loop even if you don't have spurious wakeups. For example, you might say, well, signal seems like a good way of saying it's okay to remove an item from a queue, but what if another thread, you know, you signal a thread to wake it up, but another thread just acquires the lock before that one and removes the item from the queue? That sort of scenario is hard to avoid unless signal does some additional stuff about making sure that threads acquire the lock in the order you expect. That they actually end up running in the order they're signaled and that you don't have like a new thread acquire the lock before a signal thread does. And that makes it harder to implement. And we'll go through an example which should make this clear. But with pthreads and also every other implementation of condition variables that I can think of you using, like Java's and so on, there are spurious wakeups. So you have to write the loop. That is the pattern you have to use, even if there is no possible weird scenario like the one I mentioned before with signal and you know, someone else sneaking in of causing something wrong to happen, like with our finished example. So let's look at our example here of doing producer-consumer, and to keep things simpler to start out, we're doing an unbounded queue. I'll turn it into a bounded queue later. So I have an unbounded queue. So all I need to worry about is if the buffer is empty, I need to wait. So I have one condition variable, which is whether data is ready or waiting for data is ready. And I enqueue an item, I signal that data is ready on the produce side. On the consume side, while the buffer is empty, I wait. And I wait for data to be ready, and I make sure I release the lock while I'm waiting. So the producer can actually add something to the queue. And then I unlock. So we have our rule that we follow before, our shared data, we always lock before accessing. And, you know, I always, you know, I acquire the lock after I wait. Note that because I check if the buffer is empty and then dequeue, there's no code in between here and I'm holding the lock while that happens. So there's no way another consume thread can sneak in because I'm holding the lock, I check the condition, buffer is empty, and only then do I go past the while loop. So under no circumstances can someone sneak in between when I check that whether the buffer is empty and when I dequeue and also dequeue, which is good because then my dequeue would fail. And note that our signal here, the idea is we're waking up a consume thread, but sometimes there won't be any. Sometimes we'll call produce, and there's no one's waiting on the consume, and we'll call signal, that's fine. There's no one to wake up, it's just gonna do nothing. And that's okay, because when a consumer does come along, it's gonna check if the buffer is empty, and it's not gonna be. Okay, so any questions so far? Yeah?
When wait returns, does it acquire
a
lock then?
Yes, when wait returns, does it acquire a lock then? Yes. The rule is that, it's only unlocked while you're waiting, and it's in fact, you get added to the wait queue such that there's no, you're on the wait queue before the lock is unlocked. Yeah, and it returns with the lock held, which is why this worked, even when we do one iteration of the loop. So we have this loop here. So let's reason about when we can have 0, 1, or 2 iterations of the loop. Let's go through some examples. So we have our case where we have no iterations of this loop. That's possible. Produce happens. It enqueues. It calls signal, which does nothing because there's no one waiting, and unlocks. Then consume happens. We lock. We check if it's empty. It's not. We don't do any iterations of the loop. We just dequeue an item and keep going. Okay. So we can have 0 iterations. We don't do any waiting. We can have 1 iteration. We call consume. We lock. We check if it's empty. We simultaneously unlock and start waiting with a con wait. Produce runs. It calls lock. It enqueues. It signals, which lets us stop waiting, but wait won't return until we acquire the lock again. So produce unlocks, so then we can go. We check if it's empty. It's not now, so we exit the while loop, we dequeue an item, unlock, and return. Okay, so makes sense. So then we have the 2 plus iteration case. So one way we could have more than one iteration is if we had a spurious wake up. But another way is a scenario like this, where we need at least 3 threads to do this. So we call consume, we start waiting because the queue is empty. Okay, and we're waiting here, produce, we lock, we enqueue, we signal, so we're stopping waiting, and now we're waiting for the lock, but we're unlucky that some other consume thread comes along, it acquires the lock, and it somehow wins. It's a little faster than us. So we get unlucky here. It checks if it's empty. It's not. And it dequeues an item. So when we acquire the lock afterwards, like we're supposed to, we check if it's empty, and it still is. And this is the scenario I said, which is hard to avoid. So there's one way we could imagine that signal and con wait could be implemented to help us avoid this scenario. And the problem is that the thread that we signaled is not guaranteed to get the lock right away, because we're just using normal locks, which don't have any particular idea about who gets the lock first. It just depends on what the scheduler decides to run whether it decides to run thread 2 or thread 3 first when the lock is unlocked. And either could happen. We could have an alternate design where we somehow modify the lock so we guarantee that the signal thread gets it next, that we hand off the lock to the signal thread and not any other thread. And this is a real thing that people have implemented. It's called core scheduling. And I do not know of any current threading implementation that you would be likely to ever see that does it. But it is a real thing people have proposed. People don't do it, probably because it makes the threading implementation slower and harder to write. So the other style is called Mesa style. These are both based, so Hoare is the author of presumably the proposal of doing this style of scheduling. Mesa was a system out of Xerox PARC, which did the other style. So everything I know of implements Mesa style, where the lock doesn't do anything special. They just use the fastest implementation of the lock, which doesn't handle this, hand off the lock to a particular thread thing. So, which means that you can, even without spurious wakeups, you can have these sorts of situations where you get unlucky, because there's no guarantee that just because you woke up, you get the lock right away. And that's, I think, where I'll finish up today. So next time, we'll talk about a few more examples of using monitors and relating monitors and condition variables. Then moving on to deadlock maintenance.